I'm Veronica Dudo. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, more military action.
The U.S. seizes a Russian-flagged oil tanker in the Atlantic. Why the Trump administration says it acted within its rights.
Is Cuba next? Why one U.S. senator close to the Trump administration says the idea is not too far-fetched. Extraordinary meeting. Pope Leo holds the first consistory of his papacy. The main topics he'll discuss with the College of Cardinals. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the feast of St. Raymond of Peñafort. Our top story tonight. The United States enforces its blockade around Venezuela by seizing two more oil tankers, including one connected to Russia. The takeovers played out in the Atlantic Ocean and Caribbean, marking another escalation after the U.S. imprisoned Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
Veronica, good evening to you. Today, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt told a packed briefing room that the U.S. has maximum leverage over the interim authorities in Venezuela right now. Also discussed, Greenland.
Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt insists the United States was within its rights to seize two more oil tankers.
And this administration is going to fully enforce the sanction policy of the United States.
Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem says the U.S. Coast Guard boarded two Ghost Fleet tanker ships because they were either last docked in Venezuela or en route to it. Noem writes, motor tanker Bella One has been trying to evade the Coast Guard for weeks, even changing its flag and painting a new name on the hull while being pursued in a desperate and failed attempt to escape justice.
This was a Venezuelan shadow fleet vessel that has transported sanctioned oil. The vessel was deemed stateless after flying a false flag, and it had a judicial seizure order. And that's why the crew will be subject to prosecution.
President Donald Trump also says Venezuela agreed to turn over up to 50 million barrels of oil to the U.S., adding, this oil will be sold at its market price, and that money will be controlled by me as President of the United States of America to ensure it is used to benefit the people of Venezuela and the United States. President Trump's top diplomat, with a Secretary of War behind him, told reporters today, phase one is the stabilization of the country. He doesn't want to see Venezuela descending into chaos. Phase two, recovery.
And that is ensuring that American, Western, and other companies have access to the Venezuelan market in a way that's fair. Also, at the same time, begin to create the process of reconciliation nationally within Venezuela so that the opposition forces can be amnestied and released and from prisons or brought back to the country and begin to rebuild civil society.
President Trump also draws international concern over his approach to Greenland. He believes America should control the island to protect the U.S. from Russia and China's intrusion in the Arctic. But Greenland is part of Denmark, America's NATO ally. The president posts, we will always be there for NATO, even if they won't be there for us. The only nation that China and Russia fear and respect is the DJT rebuilt USA.
And I would point out that the acquisition of Greenland by the United States is not a new idea. This is something that presidents dating back to the 1800s have said is advantageous for America's national security.
And Secretary of State Marco Rubio also told reporters today that President Trump's intention was always to buy Greenland. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
Diego Rivera Rivota joins me now. He's a senior research associate at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you. Hello, Veronica.
Venezuela is incredibly rich in natural resources, most notably holding the world's largest proven oil reserves. Can you tell our viewers more about their natural resources?
Yeah, gladly. So as you well mentioned, Veronica, Venezuela holds the largest reserves in oil in the world. Now, in terms of other wealth, natural gas is very important. Venezuela holds the largest natural gas reserves in Latin America as well. And there's some important minerals, wealth and reserves as well, that has been less produced. Now, having said that, in terms of production, it's important to note that at current level production levels, Venezuela only produces about 900,000 barrels per day. That is less than 1% of global demand of oil. So to put in perspective, that is not that relevant in terms of global demand, right? In terms of natural gas, those volumes are also not widely traded or consumed regionally. So focusing particularly on oil, I think that is an important notion. That is, while it holds the largest reserves of the world, it accounts for less than 1% of global demand. And another, a second important element, really on the basics of this oil, is the type of it. It is what we call extra heavy oil, and it's very sour. What does that mean? Essentially, that is a type of crude oil compared to other ones that is very dense, almost, very, very difficult to extract and then to manipulate. And so it requires a specific technology, technical procedures, and it's very intensive in terms of energy and carbon emissions to produce it. It requires the addition and the blend with naphtha, with distillates of oil, and the sourness, that basically means that it's very high in sulfur. So its processing and refining process requires a specific setups and configurations that basically makes it trade as a discount compared to other higher quality crudes. Right.
Venezuela.
So that is a relevant one. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Venezuela is among the world's most heavily sanctioned countries, alongside Russia, Iran, Syria, and others, a status that has severely restricted its access to international finance and trade. If those sanctions are lifted, what impact could that have on global markets?
Indeed, you are correct. Venezuela has heavy sanctions. They started ramping up in 2019 and with the first Trump administration. Already that if that you mentioned is a pretty big one. We'll see how things develop. As we know, things are changing almost by the minute during these last days. So considering, in a potential scenario where that happened, I think given that, along with a minimal level of standards in which regulations, stability, physical certainty, as well as legal regulatory framework, allows to some investment of some oil companies, I don't think, and other observers and analysts coincide in this, that Venezuela's oil production could reach somewhere close to the pre-sanctioned volumes that it has prior to 2019. That means around 1.5 million barrels per day from just less of 1 million barrels that we see today. But that will take time, at least 2-3 years. Different outlooks have different views on this. But, this is a specific scenario where we're painting a very favorable set of situations. And if all of those align together, then we could see that with, let's say, relatively, not an irrational level of investment, something in the realm of possibility that could happen, which is far, let me tell you, from the peak level of production that Venezuela had of 3.5 million barrels per day in the late 1990s, and only in 2015, where it produced around 3 million barrels per day.
Diego Rivera Rivota, thank you so much.
Thank you, Veronica. Have a great day.
On the heels of the congressional briefings from Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Secretary of War Pete Hegseth, and other officials at the Capitol about the military operation in Venezuela, some lawmakers say they are concerned that President Trump is embarking on a new era of U.S. expansionism, possibly including other Latin American countries. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us with the latest. Eric.
Good evening, Veronica. Yes, for months, the U.S. military prepared for the strike in Venezuela. Now, many Cubans are wondering if they're next. And that may not be too far-fetched, according to several Republicans up here on Capitol Hill. I did speak with Senator Lindsey Graham, a GOP foreign policy hawk who spent the entire weekend with President Trump, including during the military operation which captured Maduro. He told me Cuba is a communist dictatorship that has killed priests and nuns, a country that preys on their own people, and adds their days are numbered.
The communist dictatorship in Cuba is literally on life support. It cannot survive, in my view, without Venezuela and Russia, and both of them have been taken out of the game.
Senator Graham says with the U.S. in charge of Venezuelan oil, the U.S. could starve Cuba. Since the rise of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela in 1999, Cuba has depended heavily on Venezuela for subsidized oil in exchange for Cuban medical professionals, military advisors, and security forces. Without Venezuelan oil, Cuba's economy, which is already in a deep crisis, will likely spiral even further.
The Trump approach is to take a distressed property, fix it up, and create value. And I look at Venezuela and Cuba as countries full of very talented people that have been run poorly.
But not all Republicans are on board.
Are there many people around the world that have been accused of crimes? Does this mean we have carte blanche, that the president can make the decision anytime, anywhere, to invade a foreign country and remove people that we've accused of a crime?
It's gunboat diplomacy, and I repudiate that. The question I have, what's in this for the American people? How is this going to help us?
Others say President Trump's America First agenda is on full display.
If we can get democracies in Cuba and democracies in Venezuela, democracy in Nicaragua, think of what the opportunity for this hemisphere is. The people in those countries, their opportunity, and the trade we'll have with Americans.
Senator Scott adds that American military bases in Cuba would help to blunt China, Russia, and Iran's influence in the region. Democrats say what's to stop other countries, like China, from doing the same thing?
What now prevents Xi from saying, from a Chinese court indicting a Taiwan leader and then scooping them up and arresting them? What prevents Putin from doing that to Ukrainians?
And by the way, later this week, the Senate will be voting on a war powers resolution, which could prevent President Trump from further military action on foreign soil. But even if it does pass the House, it would be largely symbolic because President Trump will likely veto any legislation to limit his authority. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
A woman is dead in Minnesota after a shooting involving officers with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE. It happened today in Minneapolis. According to the Department of Homeland Security, the woman tried to run over an ICE agent during an immigration crackdown in the city. The city's mayor said the agent acted recklessly and not in self-defense. As of right now, the identities of the victim and the agent are unknown. Today is the first day of Pope Leo's first extraordinary consistory in Rome. The two-day gathering will be held behind closed doors, bringing together cardinals from all over the world. EWTN Vatican journalist Benedict Settegrin has more.
After closing the holy door of St. Peter's Basilica, Pope Leo opened his first extraordinary consistory in the Vatican this afternoon. The meeting will last 2 days and will be guided by several topics: the missionary nature of the Church, the role of the Curia and its relationship with the particular churches, as well as synodality and the liturgy. All cardinals have been summoned for this extraordinary consistory, which, unlike an ordinary one, is not public and addresses issues of exceptional importance, urgency, or gravity for the universal Church. Almost 12 years have passed since the extraordinary consistory convened by Pope Francis on February 20th and 21st, 2014, ahead of the Synod on Family. Pope Francis convoked two other extraordinary gatherings of the cardinals in 2015, also on the Family, and 2022 on his reform on the Roman Curia. Currently, the College of Cardinals numbers 245 members, of whom 122 are electors and 123 are non-electors. Since January 5th, when Cardinal Mario Zanardi, Apostolic Nuncio to Syria, turned 80, non-voting cardinals have outnumbered voting cardinals for the first time in the history of the Church. The program for this extraordinary consistory includes three working sessions in the new Synod Hall. After opening remarks by Cardinal Giovanni Battista Re, the Dean of the College of Cardinals, and an introductory address by Pope Leo, the nearly three-hour-long first session will unfold in working groups and conclude with an address by the Holy Father in the evening. Tomorrow morning, January 8th, Pope Leo will concelebrate Mass with the cardinals at the altar of the chair in St. Peter's Basilica. The consistory will then resume with communal prayer, group work, and reports. After lunch, the cardinals will gather again for the final session. The extraordinary consistory will conclude on Thursday evening with an address by the Holy Father and the Te Deum. Following this, the Vatican will hold a press briefing in the Holy See press office to comment on the proceedings. The consistory has been framed as a moment of common discernment and fraternity between the Bishop of Rome and the Cardinals, a theme Pope Leo first emphasized when he met with the College of Cardinals just 2 days after his election and stressed their importance and value in the life of the Church.
You, dear Cardinals, are the closest collaborators of the Pope. This has proved a great comfort to me in accepting a yoke clearly far beyond my own limited powers, as it would be for any of us.
Just 8 months into his pontificate, Pope Leo's first extraordinary consistory will be significant for the Church. It will offer the first clear glimpse of the direction his pontificate is taking and the issues he will focus on in the months ahead. In Rome, Benedictia de Grian for EWTN News Nightly.
We have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly. Turned upside down, what changes the Trump administration is making to the nation's dietary guidelines? And picking up the pieces, we speak with one family 1 year after they lost everything in the California wildfires. To replace Marjorie Taylor Greene is officially underway. Governor Brian Kemp has set a special election for March 10th to fill the remainder of her term. Following her resignation, nearly two dozen candidates have already filed to run, mostly Republicans looking to represent the deep red district. Candidates have until January 14th to qualify. The high-profile contest serves as a major test for the Republican Party. Greene's departure, along with the death of Representative Doug LaMalfa, have left House Republicans with a narrow five-seat majority. The Trump administration has released the 2025 through 2030 U.S. dietary guidelines. It now introduces a simplified 10-page roadmap for national nutrition. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. emphasizes a transition to whole foods featuring an upside-down food pyramid that prioritizes proteins and healthy fats. The updated guidance seeks to end the war on saturated fats, now approving whole food sources like meat, whole fat dairy, and beef tallow. Strict new limits target ultra-processed products and added sugars, capping sugar intake at just 10 grams per meal. The standards aim to overhaul the American food supply and promote long-term public health. It's been 1 year since the devastating wildfires in California, and many residents are still recovering after being displaced or losing their homes. The Eaton and Palisades fires burned more than 37,000 acres of land, leaving 31 dead. The fires were contained after 3 weeks, leaving thousands of homes destroyed, many of which hope to be rebuilt by 2027. Tony Costanzo, a resident of California affected by the 2025 wildfires, joins us now. Tony, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Can you share more with us about last year's wildfires and how they affected you and your family?
Well, we lost everything. We lost our home. We lost all of our personal possessions. We lost personal possessions that can never be replaced. Wedding albums, items that have been in our family for generations. We lost a pet. We lived in the home with our children their whole lives ever since we were married. It took years to build that home. It was a historic home, but we added on to it. And in one day, it was all gone.
Looking back on the past year, how has your faith given you hope in such a time of loss?
Well, our faith has been very important to us. We have a great parish, St. Bede's in La Cañada. They've been very supportive. They have not forgotten us. They're constantly checking in on us, having us over. So it makes us stronger in our faith, to know that we have that type of support, that type of love from family, friends, and from our parish.
Now, if people want to help families like yours to be able to continue to recover, what's the best way?
I think the best way is to contact the local Catholic churches in the affected fire zones. The Catholic churches are very organized in reaching out to parishioners who lost their homes or whose homes were damaged. And they put together funds from generous parishioners.
Now thousands lost homes and most have not even been able to start to rebuild yet. What has the recovery process been like physically and emotionally?
Well, physically it's been very slow, painfully slow. In some ways we understand our land is still toxic. We don't want to speed up building on toxic land. So there's a waiting process, requires patience. Right now we're stable. We're in an apartment, so we relocated. We're comfortable. So it's that relocation that helps us pace ourselves for a long-term rebuilding.
Please know of our continued prayers for your family and the community still recovering. Tony Costanzo, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, starting fresh, as we enter a new year, Pope Leo begins a new catechesis series, what this one will focus on. The Israel Defense Forces have escalated their response to recent border provocations neutralizing a Hezbollah operative in southern Lebanon. Military sources confirm the strike targeted an individual from the 127th Aerial Unit who was actively involved in rebuilding terror infrastructure. This mission follows a series of precise engagements intended to dismantle subterranean facilities and rearmament efforts. Israeli officials emphasize the actions are a direct consequence of persistent ceasefire violations. The IDF says it remains committed to ensuring security and preventing any further regional escalation. Tonight, we are joined by Father Daniel Carew, Regional Director for the Jesuit Refugee Service in the Middle East and North Africa. He has spent the past 6 years serving displaced people in Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria. Welcome to the show and welcome to the studio.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
So first, can you tell us more about the JRS Migrant Center, which operates today?
Exactly. So JRS operates in the Middle East, in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Iraq. And so we have overview of those four country operations. The Migrant Center in particular is a program much like a lot of our programming. As Jesuits, we've been in the Middle East, what is now today Lebanon and Syria, since 1656. And so our window is the last 350 years, and our vision of the future is the next 350 years. The particular emergency of the Syria war and the Syria crisis is 14 years old. A lot of the other NGOs that we're working with, partnering with, they have a window of 5 or 10 years. Our window as a Jesuit organization is a much bigger window. And so as we're looking at that work, we're looking at the education. As a predominantly Jesuit organization, we're looking mostly at the education, but the cora personalis, the care of the whole person. How are we able to see that whole person and the entire family structure around them and care for them, not only the children in the classroom, social workers there in the classroom ready for them when they're dealing with trauma histories, but also with their family, so their older sisters and their mothers, women support groups and things in the community centers that we have, those in all four of those different countries that we're operating.
Now, there was reports of another airstrike in southern Lebanon. How fragile is the situation down on the ground?
It's a good question. I will say, you know, at the anniversary of the ceasefire, so in late November, UNIFIL, the UN peacekeeping force in between Lebanon and Israel, they reported the numbers of violations of that ceasefire. In the 12 months since the ceasefire was begun, Israel had violated it more than 10,000 times. So this is a regular occurrence. We see this all the time. We hear the drones in the sky every day. When there are attacks north of the Latani River, closer to Beirut or in the Bekaa Valley, those are moments when we get a little bit more cautious. But there is regular conflict. Israel violated it 10,000 times. Hezbollah seems to have violated it about 10 times. So the numbers are quite stark there. But it is a regular reality. We are very aware, and a lot of my Lebanese staff, are very concerned that something would escalate in the coming months.
Father Daniel Carew, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Today, Orthodox churches celebrate Christmas, and Christians in Gaza celebrate the holiday under the shadow of war once again. Palestinians joined in prayer for Christmas Day Mass, although residents say this year's celebrations weren't the same.
Unfortunately, this is the second year we are celebrating during the war that was imposed on us in Gaza. The holidays lack joy and peace because this holiday is originally based on joy and peace.
Celebrations were held at St. Porphyrius Church, one of the oldest Christian churches in the world, which sustained an airstrike early in the war. Following the Jubilee year's focus on the mysteries of the life of Jesus, Pope Leo begins a new catechesis series on the Second Vatican Council and stresses that its teaching still serves as the guiding star of the Church's journey.
Che in Cristo ci chiama a essere suoi figli.
At today's general audience, the Holy Father recalled the 60th anniversary of the Second Vatican Council. He encouraged the faithful to reread the documents and reflect on the teachings about the new situation of the Church in the current globalized society. Pope Leo said the documents are still relevant today and can help us embrace the changes and challenges of the modern age in dialogue and co-responsibility as a Church. We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, YouTube, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Veronica Dudo. Good night and God bless.